You know what it is?
It's the ABCs.
The ABCs. You know what you call that?
Alphabet.
The alphabet. You know, the first time I saw that, though, I didn't know it was the alphabet. I thought it was a word. Oh, I was so embarrassed. I remember it clearly.
Abkadefki Jekyll-Menopkorstuvrix is the most remarkable word I've ever seen. Abkadefki Jekyll-Menopkorstuvrix is, I wish I knew exactly what I mean. It starts out like an A word, as anyone can see, but somewhere in the middle it gets awful queer to me. Abkadefki Jekyll-Menopkorstuvrix is, if I ever find out just what this word can mean, I'll be the smartest bird the world has ever seen.
We're kind of heading into the second hour here. I want to kind of maybe throw a slight change of pace here and get into some of the specifics of what you guys have found. And if you don't mind, I want to selfishly start with a discovery that, Scott, you led me to. And I just want to kind of read you a little quick something here. It's from the first Secrets in Plain Sight. You talk about there is outside of the Met Museum, which has this beautiful Temple of Dendur exhibit. And there is, right outside the museum, there is a reservoir that has an aqueduct cutting across it. And you pointed out that the aqueduct points directly into the heart of the inner chamber of this Temple of Dendur. Can you picture what I'm talking about?
Definitely, yeah.
Okay. So, that reservoir has been renamed after Jackie Onassis, right? So, but the temple inside was meant to be a memorial to JFK. So I'm just going to read you this. I found this in a book. This was an autobiography of Jackie Onassis. Sorry. Reading Jackie, Her Autobiography in Books. It's written by William M. Kuhn. He says, several books from her last month also indicate Jackie's love of history. Isis and Osiris, Exploring the Goddess Myth, 1994, tells the story of the ancient Egyptian goddess Isis, who married her brother Osiris. Osiris died in a violent death with his brother Set, who cut Osiris to pieces, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I'm going to skip over the mythology we know. Here we go. The Temple of Dendur had originally been dedicated to the worship of Isis. Although Jackie had worked hard to have the temple saved, she was not initially happy about bringing it to New York. When Tom Hoving phoned her in the 1960s to see if she would support the Met's application to acquire it, she told him she did not want it in the museum. She wanted to keep the original plan of rebuilding it in Washington as a memorial to JFK. When the Met won the competition to get the temple and is reconstructed within view of her apartment, she complained about reflections from the floodlights at night shining to her bedroom. By the time that Jackie was working with Kot on Isis and Osiris, she had forgotten all about that. She ends up rather liking the temple. It enhanced the view. She remained interested in anything ancient or modern that had to do with Egypt, etc., etc., etc. But the fact that this was something where she wanted to have this temple, she worked to actually bring that temple over, wanted it as a memorial to JFK, and now this aqueduct cutting across it points directly to this memorial. And I go on to write about the fact that these two figures, Jackie very much resonates Isis, and JFK very much resonates with Osiris, but I just wanted to sort of point that out, that there was just a minute or so clip from your four-hour video, and I felt like you could take any one of these things and really dive into it, because that connection is really profound for me and the material that I've been working on.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's really a nice connection. I knew that she had received the temple ceremonially for the United States, and sort of acting like Isis there. But I didn't know that she was fascinated by Isis and Osiris. And I knew she lived nearby, but I didn't know she could see it from her bedroom window. My God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jack in the box.
And you know, if you extend that line through the Jackie's Reservoir through the Met, it goes right to the UN, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, okay,
too.
Yeah. Well, then I'll throw you one more. They renamed. I lived in New York my whole life, but just in the last year moved away. There is the Triborough Bridge, which is this bridge that splits into three, covering three different boroughs, and they renamed that for Bobby Kennedy. So it's actually now the RFK Bridge. It used to be the Triborough. And I could send you this image, but if you take where the exit ramp of that bridge comes off, and there's running next to it is a train that just runs parallel, or ever so slightly off parallel, is a train that runs across. And these bridges are very much associated with each other, and I could go into that, which I won't waste your time. I want to hear your guys' input, but just to let you know, if you draw a line from the where it goes onto the borough of Queens from this what's called the Hellgate Bridge and the Triborough Bridge or the RFK Bridge, and you draw a line out, you will essentially be like two extending arms that reach out into the bay and essentially embrace JFK Airport. Like, you could just do a straight line from each of those two bridges, which are right next to each other, draw it out, and it basically cups JFK Airport. So you have RFK and JFK sort of being aligned in that fashion.
It seems like it was planned, doesn't it?
Right. I know. Again, this is why I'm still open to that. I still always entertain that possibility. The fact that she worked on this temple, all this sort of stuff, and yet, again, it's when you continue to extrapolate, continue to explore, I find there's a certain amount that seems planned, and there's very much where I say, I think for myself, it's when I take it into the personal life, and I know, well, I didn't plan that, and I don't think I have some CIA handler hanging out outside my door telling me what to do or beaming messages into my brain, you know, so...
Exactly. So it's you're noticing that it just works out this way. It just happens to be reality configures itself in a way that encodes these patterns. So the question is, who is the planner? We still have that as a mystery.
That reminds me of, I read somewhat recently an article from Vanity Fair about Stanley Kubrick. And the guy's talking about how Kubrick had sent the head of Warner Brothers in the 70s an unabridged copy of The Golden Bough. And for every 2 weeks for like a year, Kubrick would contact this person and ask him if he had gotten into it yet. And the guy eventually told him, he's like, look, I'm so busy, I don't have time for mythology. And Stanley Kubrick replied, this isn't mythology, this is your life. And looking at The Golden Bough and anthropology, and the way that things translate, there's a compartmentalization that often happens for people looking into that stuff, where they don't recognize how it relates to modern times and how we're still playing out the exact same archetypes and stories over and over again. And JFK is like a really direct example of that kind of thing.
You know, this idea of our entire lives almost being mythologies, and that we're playing out the same kind of archetypes. And then we talked about Jackie Onassis and JFK. Well, you know, it's almost like that they are playing out the archetype of Osiris and Isis, right? Because of course,
yeah.
Osiris was killed, right? And we're saying the same thing. You know, I think that there's a lot of truth to this. And I think when you get into esoterica, you realize that, you know, there really is only kind of one story, and that everybody's kind of playing out individually through their own lives this one story. I mean, I don't know if you guys know James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake.
Sure, that, yeah, we've talked about that a lot on here.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. So you guys know that well. So, I mean, that's basically what that whole book is about. You know, you have this guy, Humphrey Tipton Earwicker, that is basically, he's like, what, like 10,000 different characters, 10,000 different points in history, and yet he's playing out one story, right? And of course, what's that story? Well, it's this story of, I mean, well, it's Finnegan waking up, if you will, right? It's Finnegan's Wake, You know, it's like he's waking up to, I mean, I take the spiritual aspect of this, if you will, but waking up to his own true divine nature, you know? So, I mean, I think that every single one of our lives, it's almost like, you know, once again, we can take this to the mathematics or the numbers and the intelligent force behind creation, that there is, you know, that we're all playing out this archetype. And once you start to understand it and kind of elevate your consciousness and see it, you're going to start seeing these patterns and things like that come about in your entire life, if you will. So.
Yeah, I think on this show and sort of our, you know, I don't know, sometimes called synchromystic community, I think we're sort of exploring the monomyth, and then we, I don't want to speak for everyone, but I for lack of a better ability, I will. I think we're looking at kind of this monomyth. We're looking at the stories and how they all kind of are telling the same archetypes. So there's this idea of a monomyth, Joseph Campbell, all this sort of stuff. And then we look at what you guys are doing and seeing almost a validation, because once you sort of throw this mathematical element on it, it's like, oh, there's a formula, or that it works in both ways. And then it's interesting to hear you both saying, looking at these numbers, and we see it telling a story, and it's almost like we're looking at each other from almost two sides of the same coin, right? Saying, oh, okay, I'm looking at a story, and then, oh, on the other side, I see these numbers add up to the same thing. And you're saying, I'm looking at these numbers, I look at the other side, and I see that the stories add up to the same thing. I can't help but think this is exactly when we talk about the idea of gematria, the idea that the numbers and the letters are sort of equivalent. It seems almost built into the very architecture of, again, these languages that we use, that math is very much a language.
Yeah, Alvin Boyd Kuhn, let me see if I can say this. He has this great quote where he said, Pythagoras said, God geometrized and created in the world. He built the universe on number. And like works like the Zohar and Jewish Kabbalistic literature like that reveal clearly that the deity formed the creation by means of the alphabet. And so it's this idea that, yeah, I mean, and of course, then you look at our alphabet in and of itself, and what are they? Well, they're just simple constructions of lines and arcs. It's geometry. And so even, you know, we think of words, we think of stories, you know, and we start breaking this stuff down. But at the heart of it, if you really get down to it, we're reading geometry. That's what we're reading. You know, we're reading, you know, arcs and lines and that sort of thing. And so the idea of, once again, you know, Plato said all is number, or Pythagoras said all is number. Plato said, you know, numbers are the highest degree of knowledge. It is knowledge itself. This idea that I think when you start to get into understanding mathematics and geometry and that sort of thing, you start reading the story of creation. And that story of creation is a universal, meaning one, uni, and verse, line of poetry. And that we're kind of living out this monomyth, this line of poetry in our own lives individually.
Marty, if you don't mind, I want to ask you for something specific here.
Sure.
So it occurred to me the other day that we're speaking to Scott Onstott and Marty Weeds, and I'm a big fan of Back to the Future, and I think, great Scott and Marty. And I'm like, so I'm thinking Back to the Future here, right? Yeah. Now, of course, in Back to the Future, they go 88 miles per hour to activate the flux capacitor and all this sort of stuff. And we've spoken about on this show the connection between the flux capacitor and the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. We've spoken about there is this other film called The Phantom Tollbooth, an adaptation of the book, where in this cartoon adaptation, they basically do almost the exact same thing. It's this kid driving this car through the toll booth, and as he's about to go through, the toll booth says, Rule 88. And like, so like there's this 88 said to him just before he goes through this Stargate toll booth thing, and it just goes on and on and on and on. And I was thinking about this number 88 and what's the significance of it, and then just before we did this show, I wanted to put up on Facebook, I put up on the Syncbook Facebook page, I said, hey, in an hour we're going to speak to Scott Onstott and Marty Weeds. In the meantime, check out their appearances on our sister program, 42 Minutes. It occurs to me, Scott, you were on 42 Minutes episode 88, which I didn't realize till just an hour ago. So I'm curious, what do you guys got on the number 88?
There are 88 constellations. And there are 88 keys in the piano.
Yeah, Yeah, and well, so 88 keys on the piano is actually 7 1/3 octaves. And this is basically the range, that the comfortable range that human beings hear at. And of course, like the cochlea and the eardrum of your ear is, you know, this ingeniously crafted thing that allows us to receive this sound. Well, you have 28 phalanges on your hands. So you have 2 on your thumb and 3 on each finger, right? So this gives you 28. Well, 88 divided by 28. So if you put your hands on the piano and you're playing the piano, grand piano, 88 divided by 28 is 3.142. It's pi. And hence why you play the piano. You know, another interesting thing is Hermes and Thoth in this cipher both equal 28, and they're akin. Well, Hermes was Hermes Mercurius Trismegistus, right? And so these gods are, you know, the of course mythological gods are attributed to the planet Mercury. Well, Mercury is known as the messenger of the gods, and of course this is what the idea of Hermes and Thoth were. They were bringing the arts of, well, things like astronomy, writing, you know, et cetera, mathematics to human beings. So they were actually the messenger of the gods. And of course, Mercury is the closest planet to the sun. Well, Mercury has an orbital path of 88 days. So Mercury, orbital path of 88 days divided by the gematria equivalents of both Thoth and Hermes equals, once again, pi. It's 88 divided by 28. So 3.142. And so once again, it's like, okay, well, did the people that were creating, you know, crafting the language of English or whatever and writing these, translating these names from, you know, Greek, which translated from Latin, which translated, you know, et cetera, did they know this, or was just this something that came about organically? And I really think you could answer either way, you know?
Oh. You know, so that reminds me of, you know, the divine Pymender from Greek, which they say was from the Egyptian, but it was destroyed in the Library of Alexandria, where in there you have the first man, which is like the equivalent of the Adam. He looks into the 7 rings and gets mesmerized by the levels and then basically falls through the rings and then can't figure out how to get back. And he ends up in the world of form that we know. It's kind of their version of the fall. You know, I find that really applicable if you relate the 7 rings to kind of like the spectrum that we're dealing with, like a movement accomplished in 6 stages and the 7th brings return. And so you have the cycle gets introduced, and so to transcend it would be to go, you know, 88 miles an hour is to take all the keys, and that there's something beyond. It's like somewhere over the rainbow or something.
Another really interesting thing about 88 is that in the Fibonacci sequence, you have the first basic, I mean, you can term the Fibonacci sequence in basically kind of 2 different ways, but, and, you know, the first 10 digits of the Fibonacci numbers, what is 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34. So this is the first 10 digits of the Fibonacci series. Well, adding 0 plus 1 plus 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 5 plus 8 plus 13 plus 21 plus 34 equals 88.
Nice.
Well, why this is important is that 10 digits, well, this refers right to your 10 fingers. And of course, once again, that's the 28 phalanges on your 10 fingers. So we add up the first 10 digits of Fibonacci sequence, it equals 88. And then we look at our 10 fingers and we have 28 phalanges. And once again, so we find pi within the Fibonacci sequence. And that's just relating the human being to phi.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and another interesting thing about, you know, 88 as well, and relationship to 10 and 28 is that the first verse of Genesis in English is 10 words. So in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And then in Hebrew, it's actually 28 letters. And so you can see that Genesis 1:1 is both verses, whether you're in English or Hebrew, are referring to your 10 fingers, you know, and the 28 phalanges of each. So once again, it's, now we're talking about the grand piano. We're talking about Genesis 1:1. We're talking about the Fibonacci sequence. We're talking about the 88 constellations. Was that found by Ptolemy or was that later? I think it was later than that, wasn't it? But anyway, you can see now we're tying all of these different aspects of our reality, and how do we tie them together with a number? And then this is where it gets to the comical thing. And now we're tying it back to the future, you know, and it's like people will laugh at that. It's like, well, what does Back to the Future have to do with Genesis 1:1? Well, maybe a whole lot, you know, that seems.
Yeah. You just have to watch Joe Alexander's video
Maybe not.
I've got another one for 88.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
In the Secrets in Plain Sight, Volume 2, I talk about this this place in Century City, which is the financial capital of Hollywood. It's the Century Plaza Towers, and they were designed by Yamasaki, the same architect who designed the original World Trade Center Twin Towers. The complex there has two equilateral triangle towers, and they're each 44 stories high, so we have 88 altogether. And the plaza describes this thing that looks to be a Masonic compasses and square. And there's an all-seeing eye fountain above it. And it's framed by Constellation Boulevard and Avenue of the Stars, which is appropriate for Hollywood, of course. But it ties right in with the fact that there are 88 constellations. So it's all interconnected there.
Yeah, another interesting thing about 88 is this is kind of where it gets into numerology a bit, too, is that, you know, we just see the number 88 and we just look at it as a quantitative. It's just the number 88. But you can also look at the number in 8 and 8, and then we can see that, okay, well, that's, you know, 8 times 8 is 64. And now we can kind of launch into 64 if we want, if you will, you know, 64 hexagrams in the I Ching, you know, codons of DNA is 64, 64 squares in a chessboard, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is where
you look at it as infinity symbols turned on the side as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is where I think that when you start to get into the language of mathematics, that once again, where you're reading the meaning and not just a number, you know, you're reading, okay, that's not just 88. This is also constellations in the sky. This is the grand piano. But then we're going to go and actually look at the individual number and see, okay, now we're, well, what is infinity? You know, well, that's our entire universe. And you can read that in just a single number, if you will, because it's really kind of encapsulating that entire idea. Another interesting thing, this kind of goes away from 88 a little bit, but just looking at the number 8, you know, when you look at the word infinity, infinity is, of course, as far out as we can possibly go. It's infinite, right? Well, infinity is also in the finite. And so you have this idea of the, once again, the as above, so below, or the within and without, as far as we can go out, you know, as far as we look out into the universe and as far as we can look into ourselves, it's actually one movement of this great creative force, if you will. Well, when you put your pen down and draw the number 8, that's exactly what happens. You put your pen down, you're making a point of consciousness, if you will, and you go out, and then all of a sudden you start swirling back in. And so you were going out, but now you're coming back in. And then you cross that point of consciousness, which is where you first put the pen down, and you're in, and then now you're swirling back out. So in the number 8 in and of itself, you have this idea of this infinite loop of time, in and out, out and in and out, one universal movement. And so that's where you get now we're kind of transcending numerology, now we're kind of going into the symbols and the philosophical meaning of numbers.
Yeah, the first thing I think of is the double torus, if I think of an 8, because I see the loop of it, the double loop of it. It's like a zero with a twist or something.
Yeah, or Mobius strip, yeah, same kind of thing, yeah.
It could also be taken as a symbol for as above, so below, with the two circles joined.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You had mentioned Genesis 1:1, and that was an interesting interpretation. I never thought about it with the English before, but you know that in Kabbalah there's this whole thing around the first 42 letters, and you end at chaos, and the earth was chaos and void, and that's commonly related to the klipo. But isn't it interesting that, you know, God is said to have three hands for some reason? This is something that's stated in the Zohar, and if you look at the value of Yud, if you spell out Yud, which as a pictograph means hand, so Yud means hand, its value is 14. And if you add 14 plus 14 plus 14, you get 42. And the 42-letter name of God is what is inside the Tefillin scroll, inside the cube. I always found that really fascinating, and how that relates to the Sefer Yetzirah and the formation of the worlds. Pretty far out.
Yeah, Marty, you were on 42 Minutes, maybe like a month ago. And in it, you start talking about this idea of when you're juggling as the concept of having three hands. And since David and I had this conversation about the third hand of God a few months earlier, as I'm listening to your 42 Minutes interview, I'm sort of jumping up and down going, the three hands, you know. But however you want to wrap your mind around it or conceptualize it, it seems to add up very, very much.
Right. There's 14 segments on the fingers of the hand. If you look at the thumb as two, right? And so that's also included in the idea in that you have yud, fist and cough, you know, open, I believe, or maybe it's strike that reverse it. I always forget. But anyways, it's the significance of the open or closed hand and how that relates to the cube, because the Rosicrucian cross has 14 surrounding segments, which when folded becomes the cube. I mean, I've repeated this many times on this show, but I find that just such an interesting correspondence.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. The Rosicrucian cross. Can you say that again?
Yeah. So the Rosicrucian cross, which is just, you know, an unfolded cube. If you go around the outskirts of it, the amount of segments is 14, which is also really interesting because that's, in tarot, you have temperance, which is, you know, Sagittarius, course is the 14th arcana. I find that really, really fascinating.
Wow. So Osiris was cut into 14 pieces.
Exactly. Yeah. Jack in the box. It's like, and you know, you're talking about Pac-Man, and we've also gone into this whole thing with that. The day after Pac-Man came out, The Shining was released, and how many correspondences there are. It's really uncanny, actually, between between Pac-Man and The Shining, which was originally Puck-Man, which you could relate to Puck and Pan, and how you have Pan's Labyrinth and the Labyrinth in The Shining, and how The Shining, you could Apollo is known as The Shining One. Just some weird synchronistic areas to get into, but definitely some notable correspondences there.
Doesn't in The Shining, isn't Danny? Isn't at one point he's wearing a shirt, a football jersey, and it has the number 42 on it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and then he's wearing the Apollo shirt.
In
room 237. And then you have the hexagonal floor pattern, you know, when he gets up and all of that. I mean, we've gone on to this for days, but just really interesting. And that Dan, if you flip the D as Pan, as pointed out by Jay Kotza, then so I see it as Dan's Labyrinth, you know.
Yeah, I was interesting before when I heard you guys talking about Scott was relating the Mecca was it 66? 0.66,
it's 666.6 nautical miles from the western wall to the Kaaba.
Okay. So I was thinking we have, and then David took in this direction of 666, the sort of number of the beast, and related it to the Tefillin cube. I couldn't help but in my mind thinking of Saturn, again, another version of Osiris, but how Saturn often gets equated with Satan, the 666. When you mentioned, David, that the tefillin ends up wrapped around the middle finger in palmistry.
Yeah.
The middle finger is the finger associated with Saturn. Just all these different ideas of this cube.
And the hexagon on Saturn's north pole.
Right, okay, so that's a great point. Hexagon on the past, I'm trying to wrap my head around that one is, when you know, we talk about these ideas of ancient schools associating certain imagery with the actual planets. Marty, you said there was a possibility that we could have had knowledge that we had forgotten. But do you think that someone intuited this information and said, we're going to associate the hexagon with Saturn, and then, oh, it just turns out there actually is one there? Or is there the possibility that many, many, many years ago we actually had telescopes or satellites or things like that? Which way would you lean with on that?
Personally, I mean, Saturn's just the sixth planet, so it just makes sense, you know?
Right, okay.
So it's like when you really break it down and once again starting to understand geometry and things like that, I mean, that's just so, to me, common sense in a way. I mean, you don't really have to over-intellectualize it in that respect. I mean, it's really interesting that there is a hexagon on the North Pole, but at the same time, it's like, well, of course there is. If the whole thing is built off number, then of course we're going to find a hexagon in that respect.
Right.
Yeah, when it's something that's that
and,
literal.
And there's a thing that I just did, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, it's all you.
I was just saying that, I'm doing a second volume or a second edition of my volume 2, and I actually go over the solar system and how you can actually rearrange the planets. So basically, you can take the 9 planets of our solar system and put the sun in the center of them. And what you could do is just break up a pie, if you will, into 40-degree sections. So 9 planets around the central sun. And breaking it down using decimal parity, you can what happens is you rearrange the planets. I can't really go into it too much here, but you rearrange the planets. And then I don't want to go into this here. I'm sorry. It's too complex to try to understand on the air. But what happens is by rearranging the planets, Saturn and Earth stay in the same place. So, and 6 and 3, basically Earth is, of course, the third planet from the sun, Saturn is the same. And then what happens is by rearranging these planets, you can actually draw a perfect enneagram or ennead, this geometric form, enneagram, right within the circle. And this is just using simple math and simple geometry. And so if we see that, you know, if we can start to understand our world in this sort of geometric and numeric fashion, then you realize that you don't need any telescopes. You don't need any, a rocket to go visit Saturn to understand this sort of stuff, if you will. You know, it's just basic math, basic geometry. And I think that this is, I think that this is what these ancient golden age cultures or whatever completely understood. And they didn't really need to over intellectualize it. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, Saturn medievally, as opposed to the Golden Dawn association in Kabbalah, Saturn was associated with the Shekhinah or the Malkut. And so, and she's like the queen of the tree, because she's the only one that can go anywhere. Everything else is locked into a place, relatively speaking. But ultimately the tree is malleable, and she's the one that makes it malleable. So she brings the thing back together in a cube in the world that is to come in terms of prophecy. So I find it really fascinating that you're wrapping 3 loops around your middle finger associated with Saturn. It's like you're supposed to symbolically be bringing the Kabbalistic tree back into itself and reuniting the air with the Shekhinah, the masculine and the feminine, in order to bring the tree back together. So it's all very sound correspondences there that are too perfect.
You know, Saturn is, just to kind of get into the, like, yeah, esoteric side of Saturn is, you know, you have this idea of Sat Chit Ananda, you know, this, which is being, consciousness, bliss. Well, right. Sat, urn, an urn is, of course, a pot or a vessel. And so you really have the idea that Sat Chit Ananda, Sat being, you have this idea that being is put into an urn. And so this is the idea that the urn is the, of course, this is the human vessel, the being the spirit of the human being. And, of course, what is Saturn? Where is that being put in that vessel? Well, it's in time. And, of course, Saturn is Kronos. And so we're talking about chronology. So when you kind of tie this stuff, the planets, into the journey of the souls again, of the human being, once again, I mean, that's just following the language, that's following the math, and it just seems to really kind of connect and make a lot of sense, if you will.
So yeah. you had, you know, this idea of an urn is also a repository for ashes, and for me, I feel like the death and resurrection is just as much built into the architecture. It's in the Osiris myth, it's in the Saturnian myth, but it's even, so it's in this this name that you've just broken down, but even when you mentioned before Finnegan's Wake, and you said it's Finnegan waking up, but there's also the idea of a wake is essentially like a funeral. So you have the death, we call this moment of death, we also associate with the term waking up. So for me, I feel like there is something to this death and resurrection is another major nodal. You put it very, very nicely before, Marty, like a vertice in this sort of grand architecture or something. I feel like it's such a major node. Now, you have a book that's called The Peacock's Tale. I know a lot of synchronistics associate the peacock and the phoenix. I wonder, what does the peacock mean to you?
Well, I really resonate with the idea of death and resurrection. I mean, I think that this is, you know, I think this is what we're here to do as human beings, is kind of like die to, once again, that lower animal atavistic self and, you know, recognize our own divine consciousness. That's the kind of the underlying theme that I got from, you know, reading the mythologies and things like that. And so I think the this is what we're here to do. And I think this is why the death and resurrection motif is so important. And I can't believe I didn't even put the connection together, Finnegan's Wake and a death. So thank you for pointing that out. That's just fantastic. I can't believe I didn't even think of that. Can I read a quote here? This is from John Anthony West, and this is from Serpent in the Sky. It says, "Man is the sum of the principles that pervade and organize the universe. He is the self-perfecting product of the grand experiment that is organic life on Earth, embodying with him the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms. His body is the temple designed to permit him to carry out the rite of self-perfection, the only legitimate human goal." And I think that just kind of sums it up pretty well.
Totally. I'd never really got into Finnegan's Wake, though it had been recommended to me so many times. And the man who used to be our third co-host, Bill Klaus, was just obsessed with Finnegan's Wake. And there was a certain point at which he was reading something from it where he's talking about Ein Sof. And I was like, are you attaching that? Because we had been relating so much of Finnegan's Wake's ideas to Kabbalah. And then I wasn't even aware that he's actually using strictly Kabbalistic terms in a place where I wouldn't expect to see them. And so that was very verifying in terms of where he was coming from. I thought they were just happy connections. I didn't realize they were as intentional. Sounds like a fascinating book.
It's heavy sledding, but it's the one book that helped me scramble language. Because what he does, the intros, you know, river run past even Adams from the shore to bend the bay, brings his Kamaya Vokius, Commodius Vicus of recirculation back to Howth. And, it goes on and on for 600 pages like that, where you literally have to look at every single letter, every single syllable, and sound it out, and then read the sentence again for you to even get the gist of what he's talking about. And really what it is, once again, I think it's he's kind of pointing out archetypes of what it is to be a human being, the archetypes that play out in our own lives. And he's just repeating this again and again and again and again throughout the book. And a book is just genius, in my opinion. So,
I'm sure I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but Anoflia, something like that. He was a rabbi, and everything he wrote was encoded with Gematria. There have been a few people who have written things that they didn't even know how to approach until they knew the code. Plato, there's a book called The Canon, which I actually sent you a message quite a while ago, Scott, saying I think you should check out this book by William Sterling. I'm not a mathematician, but for anybody who is, The Canon by William Sterling is absolutely incredible. But he was pointing out that there's a text by Plato that they weren't even sure to attribute to Plato, even though all signs pointed to this was from Plato, because nobody knew how to read it, because the whole thing was encoded with gematria. And until they discovered that you had to go letter by letter and graph the equivalence of what those letters are mathematically, they didn't even know what the purpose of the text was or what to do with it. I found that really fascinating, because it's not even legible in the sense of like how we normally approach language.
When it was written that it would have been dangerous or heretical, so that he had to encode it, so that it could be decoded later, perhaps?
Yeah. Then you have like Eliphas Levi, on his right before he was put to death by the church, he was like, well, if I knew it was going to end this way, I probably wouldn't have been so, secretive in my approach. I probably would have just been more outright. And so I wonder about that too. It's like people are afraid to publish things because of their fear of the church, because they know that it could mean their own death,
I know this is not the most pleasant conversation, but it was something I was trying to hit on earlier. I'm curious what you guys, your sort of feelings, are you hopeful or somewhat reserved in your feelings of, I feel like every day when I look at the people that I interact with online and I see sites like MartyLeeds33.com and SecretsInPlainSight.com and I see all these things and I go, wow, we're making such great advances. And then I also see this really strong backlash of a very fundamentalist Christian conspiracy crowd that is saying everything that's not this is the enemy, is the Illuminati, is satanic, is bad. And there are days where I worry about a future in which there is a very serious backlash, where there's censorship of these ideas or a repression of these ideas. And I'm just curious, is this something that even comes into your guys' minds?
Not for me. I just go forward hoping that it'll continue as it is, with freedom to explore whatever you are interested in. But I suppose that is a possibility, that conditions could change. But it's not something that I worry too much about.
That was kind of the end of Brave New World, if I recall correctly, where it was kind of like the ruler put forward that he was like, well, we don't push people to uncover, but we don't stop them from uncovering, as you know, as far as the mysteries are concerned. At least that's how I interpret it. That it's like, it's there. It's almost like, you know, especially with the Freemasons, it seems like, yes, they're secrets, and yes, they're waiting for the public. If they're a good Mason, they're waiting for the public to become enlightened. So they're not going to stop them necessarily from that, though you could say something different about, like, homeland security, you know.
David, I just want to, you mentioned Brave New World. If anyone's interested, there's a particular scene in Brave New World where they go to, like, the orgy. I forget what they call it, like, orgy porgy or something like that. And they go to this room, and the room number is something like, like I said, it's actually been a while. I don't have the book in front of me, but it's, the room number is, I want to say, like, the date of the solstice or something, and then they sit around a round table in 12 different positions and all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, I had read that book, you know, so many times when I was younger, and then reading it just a few years ago, and I was like, oh, wait a second, he's actually encoding very specific information into this scene, that mm-hmm. it's sort of like a, it's whether you want to call that an occult ritual, or you just want to say that it's basically like a play on the planets intermingling. Very interesting.
You know, to echo what Scott was saying about the idea that, you know, some of this stuff had to be cryptically encoded to be kind of passed on, if you will. I mean, if you think about, like, right now we're in a very unique position where Scott can just put out a video and just throw it up on YouTube and have, you know, how many millions of people watch it. I don't have a publisher. I'm self-published. Because I have the free reign to put this information out, but any other time in history, chances are they couldn't do that. You know, who owned the publishing presses, you know, printing presses, things like that, that if somebody was to try to kind of bring this information out to the general public, to the general consciousness, that they wouldn't have been able to do it because they might have been stopped for certain reasons here and there. So the idea of having, I'm pretty positive about the future. I hope it continues to move on, and we're in the information age. But I also know that, you know, all it would take is a coronal mass ejection or whatever, and this thing is, you know, it's gone. And so, this is what nature is. It ebbs and flows, high tides, low tides, the moon waxes and wanes. And I think that we're in this position right now where we can bring out a lot of this information. And, you know, I think that we kind of have a responsibility to, in a way, just because, just to try to help. I think more so in history, we need validation. We need some clarification on all of these things. And so that's kind of my opinion on that. This is why I'm doing what I'm doing. So,
yeah, I don't feel like I have a choice.
Yeah, I
actually feel like it's like a demand.
Mark Passio said it. I've adopted this term, but it's like a moral obligation in a way, you know.
Totally.
With what Scott's doing and bringing out a lot of these interesting ideas in mathematics that are really kind of shunned by all the, you know, what Vinnie East would call the academia nuts, which I thought was hilarious. But, you know, bringing these out. But bringing these ideas out into the general public, it's like, okay, you're not going to reach everybody, but you know what? Maybe you'll grab a few ears, and maybe that'll, you know, make a new discovery along the way, or that'll set a new sort of renaissance of thought down the road or something like that. So once again, I think it's a moral obligation in my opinion. So, and not to sound too lofty or anything, but
no, but it's true. you know, and I have to remind myself all the time not to get hung up on that, because I don't see where everything is going. I don't know. I mean, I can look at my Vimeo account and I see the people in Russia and Brazil are watching my videos, you know, and I can only imagine what they're doing with it, you know. But the fact that it's out there, you know, and even if however many views or however, whoever or whatever, like, that's beyond me. I have my job, and the rest of it is however it plays out, you know. It's important to remember that.
Yeah, and I think we have a tendency to live in bubbles. Like, you know, because, I mean, if you look at my Facebook page, man, everybody's awake. God's within everybody's soul. You know what I mean? It's going to be a joyous day tomorrow. But I also live in southern Wisconsin right now. And, I mean, I don't get to talk to anybody about this stuff. I mean, I've tried to. I'm very passionate about the work. And so I know I can probably come off a little bit off-putting. I recognize that. I'm not so naive to not realize that. But I mean, most of the people around here want nothing to do with it. They're not interested. They don't want to hear about the phalanges of your hands or Genesis 1:1 or Jesus Christ or, you know, any of this stuff. So I think once again, it comes down to the fact that we have this opportunity to really kind of bring this information out. And I think we should.
Well, if you feel compelled to do it, just of your own, you know, following your own interest, then I think we ought to keep doing what we're doing and see what happens.
And until they burn us at the stake.
There you go.
And then we're going to be like, shit, I should have shut my mouth.
I should have said more.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I'm really going to hold on to that because, yeah, it's like every now and then I sort of like hesitate. And I'm like, oh, no, that's going to be misinterpreted. But it's like, no, yeah, you should just say what you're thinking. Like I went, Marty, you said being in southern Wisconsin. Like I said, I've lived in New York my whole life. I actually just turned 33 years old. I'm living in apartment 33. It's pretty funny. But I lived the first 32 years of my life living in New York City. I moved down to North Carolina. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is really big culture shock. But one of those things was there's a big Masonic lodge just two blocks away from my apartment. And I'm not a member of the Masons. I don't really have an interest in joining the Masons. That's not it. But I saw they were doing like an open house, and I just figured I'd go in there and see what they were up to. I'm not anti-Mason. As much as I have no interest in joining an organization, I'm also not opposed to it. Like, I'm not opposed to their organization, and I don't see them as inherently evil. So whatever, I just went over there, and I just went to go like kind of see what was up, and they were doing an open house. And I thought it was so telling that they did like a one-hour lecture, and the whole thing was talking about, hey, we're not evil, hey, we're not Satanists, and all this sort of stuff, like as if their whole thing was responding to criticisms and conspiracy theories, that was the only thing they could talk about it. And I sort of like raised my hand. I'm like, hey, listen, you know, I was like, as someone who is really sympathetic for what you're going through, like, you should be telling me what you are, not what you aren't, because I was like, I actually think that would go a hell of a lot further. But then, so whatever, I, you know, kind of having this conversation, and then they do this whole thing about how we accept any religion, so that they say, you know, up on our altar we have, you know, a Torah, and we have a Christian Bible, and we have... I think they had like an I Ching, and they had something else, and Bhagavad Gita, and they're like, oh, you know, we accept everybody. I said, well, here's a question. I was like, you did this whole thing about how you're not Satanist. I was like, what if I was a Satanist, and I wanted to join, would you put, you know, the Satanic Bible up on your altar? And man, you should have seen that guy break into a sweat.
Wow.
He was like, oh, and he's like looking at his boss and all this stuff, and looking around at all the, you know, good old Southern folk that are there for this thing, and he's like, oh, I don't know about that. That would have to go. We'd have to ask the Supreme Council, because he's like, it's my understanding that we're accepting of everything but as long as you're believing in God and being a good person, and I don't know that would really just totally break into a sweat. And I'm like, yeah, this is why I'm not joining any organization, because like you could say I'm going to be all inclusive and really try and entertain every idea, but and again, this could just be because I'm in the South. I don't know. Again, and I'm not even a Satanist. It was just, it's the intellectual exercise.
That's funny. I brought a collage to an old friend of mine who was raised in a Masonic community down the street from me. And, I hadn't seen him in quite a while, but I decided, for me and Amy to go out and say hello. And his house he built is just fucking unbelievable. The way, the structure of it is like, I've never seen anything like it. You know, and I hand him this collage, and the first thing he says, he kind of looks over at it, and there's an upside down pentagram on it, and goes, is that a Satanist symbol? And I was like, I don't know. It's how you want to take it. And he's like, because from my understanding, that's a symbol associated with Satanism. And I thought it was just very interesting that of all the things in this very elaborate collage, that that was the first thing he noticed, and it's the first thing he asked me about. And I was like, because I know, you know, I mean, I've seen that in Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma, that section where he's talking about Lucifer, and it's kind of like, praise be to Lucifer, like right in the middle of the text. And I wonder his feelings on that, and I don't know how they all relate to that.
Well, I'm sorry, I just will say one last thing about my experience at this Masonic Lodge. So most of the guys were these Southern guys in suits that were really kind of strange, and they just saw it as a boys network for networking and stuff. But there was this old man there who he kind of grabbed me afterwards, and me and him were just talking, and he's the guy who actually does the day-to-day work of maintenance on the building, and really incredibly nice guy. And I was like, hey, do you mind if I, like, you know, I look around, I was like, this building's beautiful, do I look? He's like, sure, I'll take you around. So he's showing me, like, everything. We go all around, and I said, hey, you've shown me all this stuff. I was like, I noticed, I didn't see any books. Do you not have a library here? And he's like, oh, come, I'll take you into the library room. Go into this room, gorgeous, all, every, like, old book you could imagine. I mean, what an incredible repository of knowledge. And I said, you know, hey, I'm curious, do you have to be a member to, like, look at these books, or like, can I come and chill here with you? And he's like, well, I would be happy to let you in here anytime you want, because he's like, the membership of this lodge wants to take all these books out and turn this into like a pool, like a billiard room. He's like, no one looks at these books anymore. He's
right.
Like, he's like, no one looks at these things anymore. He's like, so I would just be happy that someone would be interested. And this to me seems like a sort of a really interesting reality check for anyone on the conspiracy side or anything, is to say, like, what percentage of even the quote-unquote initiated are actually exploring the mysteries?
Yeah, and how many of them have even read Morals and Dogma? Because that's what I keep coming across whenever I visit there. It's like, and my friend's dad, you know, he was saying his dad is a Mason, you know, raised him a Mason, and he's never read it. Yet he's gone through, he's done all the stuff, you know, but he's not really interested. It's just more like he likes to play dress up.
Yeah, I have a friend who's a 32nd degree Freemason, and he says that very few people that are in Freemasonry are really genuinely interested in the mysteries. And, you know, he'd like to encourage more, but it's rather rare. So they maybe they're in it for other reasons.
So to build, you know, and to be part of a community, you know.
Yes, yeah.
You're going to have to apologize for my language here. I just need to preface this, but I had an old guitar teacher, and he was a Mason, and he actually got it was in his building where he had his store. His dad owned it, and his dad was a Mason, and of course his dad gave him the store, and so in order to get the cheaper rent, he became a Mason. And this is, I live in a pretty small town. It's a pretty closed-minded town. I'm not going to live here anymore, but he said that, I remember him very clearly saying this, that it was basically just an old boys club. And it was really a bunch of, if you will, small-minded white men getting together and just kind of, you know, getting together to get, you know, be away from their wives and stuff. And he said to me, he said, yeah, our credo is we hate niggers. And it stopped me cold in my tracks, and this was the first really, well, not the first experience, but one of the first experiences I've ever had with someone saying that they were a Mason, you know. And so that immediately was almost like intriguing to me, because I was just like, okay, this really shows you the gradation of who Masons are. Some of them are just porch Masons. Some of the people that are in there for, you know, just to get together with a bunch of people, like-minded people, even if it's absolute ignorant people, if you will. Some people are in it for the mystery. Some people are in it for political power and control, you know. This idea of demonized Masons, you know, demonizing these people. when you talk about morals and dogma, and he says in the middle of the book, "Hail Lucifer," you know, well, you know, Lucifer, L-U-C, comes from L-U-X, which is Latin for light. And light has always been symbolically the idea of, well, it's been the source of the creator, light, truth, wisdom, love, you know. So Lucifer just means bringer of light.
Right. So there's the argument that there's
Hail Lucifer, that's really all you say.
But there's the two lights, you know, that that there's let there be light, and then there's the sun. And so, and the sun is secondary to that light. And so there's the kind of the belief that the Luciferian thing is actually an aversion to the, it's like there's two suns in the sunset, so to speak, that there's the sun that they're worshiping, and there's the sun beyond that, which is the Ein Sof. So you have the Godhead, and then you have the God. And their God is basically the intellect. And so when the Masons are worshiping light, they're literally worshiping the intellect, which makes a lot of sense if you follow the logic of what's actually being presented in Morals and Dogma. And so, yeah, that does raise a lot of questions, and I think rightfully so.
Yeah, I'm reading Morals and Dogma right now, actually. I'm like halfway through it. And honestly, I think it's a fantastic book. I really do. I mean, it's just filled with just a lot of really great things. So I'm probably not winning any fans right now, but, but the idea of Lucifer too, about kind of worshiping the sun, as far as I understand it, has always been symbolic. You're never really worshiping the sun. You never, you know, it's basically what the sun is symbolic of. And that is the light of the creator. That is the enlivening, centering point of consciousness within the human being, you know? And the other thing about when you said your friend saw that upside down pentagram, the thing I like to point out is that's always attributed to Satan, but that pentagram only looks that way because you're looking at it from below. If you go to where God sits, then that pentagram is turned right, you know. And they also, of course, as you know, as we probably all know, the pentagram in and of itself encodes the golden ratio and the golden proportion, you know, the 1.618, and that is the balance of nature. And so the pentagram, whether you're looking at it from above or below, is talking about the great equilibrium of our creation, you know.
Right.
So all of those things can have that, you know, deeply spiritual or deeply mystical and meaning to them.
I read Morals and Dogma, and I loved it. And it's not empirical in the same way that theosophy is. And theosophy ultimately oftentimes isn't that empirical, but it's more empirical than Morals and Dogma, being that they're citing where they get everything. And Albert Pike doesn't bother with any of that. And he gives the argument that it's secret. So how would you ever find this anywhere? You know, and so he'll make statements left and right. Like, you know, there's that, whatever her name is, the woman who did the Christ conspiracy that Zeitgeist took everything from in the first section. You know, I mean, most of that is just from one book. And the only person she's citing is Albert Pike for all of that information. And so it's like, and then he doesn't cite anybody.
D.M. Murdoch? Is that who you mean?
I mean, it's a woman who has a Sanskrit name.
I think you're right, Scott. I think she uses a few different names.
D.M. Murdoch and Acharya S.
Exactly.
Acharya S.
Yes. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's the same person. That's the same person.
I listened to an interview with her and the guys who did Zeitgeist, and you could hear it in their voices, you know, which she wasn't able to cite any of her sources because she was being challenged to, and she wasn't able to cite anybody beyond Albert Pike. And it was like, well, then, and you could see the frustration of those, because I mean, now that's on Netflix, you know, how many people are fucking watching Zeitgeist, you know, and it's like, none of that is backed by anything substantial beyond Albert Pike. And so it's kind of a problem, you know,
because Albert Pike doesn't cite his references, as you said.
No,
so
he doesn't have to, because it's all secret information that's been passed down by, you know, orally, according to him. And so he doesn't care to do that. And so it makes it for a very interesting read, because, I mean, all it is synchronicity. And that's all Kabbalah is, really. And that's all theosophy is. It's just looking at these correspondences and extrapolating information from them. But oftentimes they'll make up the correspondences if they don't already exist. And that can be a little frustrating if you're really trying to find truth.
You know, Scott, one time we spoke on the phone and we were talking about this, about, you know, we've been you know, researching this stuff for how many years, and then you go to present a video or put something in a book or something like that, and then you try to think back, like, okay, where did I learn this? You know what I mean? It's like, what book did I hear this from somebody, and that sort of thing. And it gets to this point where it's almost impossible to cite all your resource, you know, your references and things like that. And to me, this is akin to playing guitar as well. How many people have I, you know, copped a lick from or something, or this hammer on was from Eddie Van Halen, or this slide was from Django Reinhardt or whatever. And then you go to write a song, and it would be like the idea of every moment in the song, every chord change that you made, it was like, okay, well, I got that from, you know, this person here, this person here. It almost becomes this impossibility. And just to kind of, you know, put that out there too, about the idea that, and once again, this also comes to, down to possession of this knowledge as well. Like, everybody wants to take, oh, this is my work, this is my work. And I try to abstain from that language, because I know that without all the people that I've been influenced by, I wouldn't be able, like Scott, Randall Carlson, you know, John Anthony West, Graham Hancock, Laird Scranton, without those like scholarly heroes, in my opinion, doing their work and putting their work forward, I wouldn't be able to do anything I'm doing. So I try to abstain from this whole like my work kind of thing. You know what I mean? I think that's a really important lesson that I think that we need to learn. Don't get me wrong. It's not like you're saying you shouldn't cite your, you know, sources and things like that. But it gets back to that whole, hey, this isn't really Pythagoras' formula. This isn't Marty Leeds' cipher. You know what I mean?
Well, right. You give names to it in market, in time, and say, oh, that's the Pythagorean theorem. But later we might learn that, well, he learned that in Heliopolis, and they've known it there for thousands of years. But it's useful to call it the Pythagorean theorem, because then we all know what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just a good convention to follow, to cite your sources, to say where you got it from, because it's a way that other people can track through the knowledge and access information more efficiently.
Exactly. With my Think Book chapter, I regretted afterwards for certain points that I was making, I forgot to reference certain people that are within our own community. And after the fact, I realized, I was like, I should have mentioned Kevin Halcott's name, not just to give him credit, so that people can look up Live from the Logosphere and follow his incredible chain of work that he put energy into, you know, and it's a valuable resource. And so, yeah, I really agree with that. It's more than just a matter of credit. It's a matter of aiding in the process of research and getting information, you know, which makes it difficult with Albert Pike, because like when he makes statements like, you know, Krishna had 12 disciples, you know, it's like, well, where is it? If it actually did say that somewhere, then you would want to look that up and find out more, you know, and you can't, because
It just requires more effort to start. Okay, well, where can I find about Krishna's 12 disciples? I'm going to have to just start from scratch on that.
Right. So with this particular example, you won't ever find that, apparently, because it doesn't exist.
Okay. Maybe he made it up.
Probably did.
Yeah.
Another thing too that I don't think that we're kind of considering this is gnosis. Is the idea of getting information directly from the source of nature, if you will. You know, I think this is something important too. I mean, this kind of goes beyond writing or sort of, you know, citing sources and things like that. But it kind of, you know, goes into the fact of philosophical deconstructions of the things that you're looking at. And a lot of times that doesn't necessarily come from another human being or necessarily come from a book or a documentary or, an interview or something like that. It just comes from your own personal psychological, you know, journey through these things. I know I've had a lot of that too, as well, where it's just kind of, I had once again, that intuitive, you know, spark or flash moment where it's just something that comes from internally. Of course, that may have been built off all the books that you read or all the people that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, gnosis and this divine mystical insight into nature, I think this is something that we're quite completely disregarding in our age as something that's even real. And I think it's as real as real as real, you know?
Right.
Well, in a physical, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Please, Scott,
I just nitpick, you know, because it's like, I would like it to be qualified if something, so if somebody says, that pointing out a hexagram or a hexagon and saying this comes from the same root as to put a hex on somebody, it's like you can look that up, and from what I gather, that's not actually, that's just some line that somebody's connecting, but that etymologically there's really no real connection that exists there. Yet at the same time, there's plenty of examples like grimoire and grammar come from the same root, and so yes, and you know, and the language to spell something or to cast a spell, etymologically, those come from the same place, which is really interesting in terms of thought, you know, but you know what I'm saying? Like that, to be able to qualify.
You're just talking about in presenting the information, but I think what Marty and Scott are speaking to is this idea of receiving the information, and this is something David and I have spoken many times. I mean, David says the word Kabbalah itself means to receive, right? Gnosis is this, like, intuitive knowing. So Scott, I feel like you got cut off there. I wanted to hear, what did you have to say about this sort of intuitive knowing? What was your experience with that?
Well, if in this age, when we generally look at things as everything must be physical and nothing can exist beyond the physical, we tend to, if there's information that seemingly comes from nowhere, it's got to be a conspiracy or a hoax. You see?
Right.
Because there's no mechanism to receive that information. So it
that's
has
great,
to be a conspiracy or hoax. Otherwise, if you are going against the mainstream view, then you can talk about gnosis or divine inspiration. But that is repugnant to people in the materialist viewpoint, because it's impossible for them.
Yeah, I just brought this up on one of the podcasts I did about, I've been getting some slack a little bit for being creative or artistic with language. You know, it's like, okay, well, there's nothing logical about that, you know, that this idea. Well, then I cite the idea that, our language was 20,000 words were created by William Shakespeare. You know, so here's a poet, a romanticist, you know, a romantic that was creating over 20,000 words of our language. And so we have this tendency to look at languages or anything that we're deconstructing in this very materialist, boxed, critical, you know, thinking sort of view. But we really have to kind of find the circle in the square, if you will, and kind of push those boundaries out and be creative as well, especially when you go down, you know, look at the fact that, hey, the language that we're speaking right now was created by, you know, romantics and poets and people that were artisans and alchemists and things like that. And this idea is
and intoxicated madmen.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we made up the whole language to begin with, you know.
Wait, Marty, I hope I wasn't cutting you off there. What I was trying to stress is that sometimes that's okay. Or we said from where I'm coming from, you know, sometimes I'm asked, what are we doing here? Because we're also doing a playful look at the archetypes and all this sort of stuff, and I sometimes explain it as psychedelics without the psychedelics. Like, it's a psychedelic mindset. But the way you sort of responded there, I wasn't sure. Do you want to distance yourself from the madmen aspect?
No, not at all. In fact, I think, save for drugs or anything like that, when you look at, you know, when we were talking about Finnegan's Wake, that's a psychedelic novel, in my opinion. I mean, that's that psychedelia all over it. And that's one of my, you know, like, that's probably one of my favorite books, top five books, I would say. So no, I don't distance myself at all from that. I think that's exactly what he's doing in this whole idea of poetic wordplay, manipulating language, you know, putting up, you know, 60,000 different languages in one or whatever, you know. I mean, he's really trying to push our understanding of our very reductionist view in deconstructing these things. And as we started this talk about like numerology in the same way, I think we can take that exact same mentality and bring it into mathematics. Now, that statement is, once again, that's completely shunned by modern mathematicians. You know, I mean, if I said that, I wouldn't be even welcomed into any university at all, you know, but I think it's imperative for us to understand our reality in that way.
I love that part in Pi when he says it's not the number, it's what's between the numbers. I like that approach. And so, you know, if we're talking about a meaningful coincidence, then we're being almost playful in our relationship to language or to whatever, you know. And that definitely has its place. Like, I love William S. Burroughs, his stuff on Egypt, and it's extremely creative, and it's his own interpretation, it's his own mind, but I know that that's what it's not pretending to be anything other than his kind of like playful, malleable approach to anthropology. But you know that from the get-go, he's not pretending to be a scholar, unlike someone like Zachariah Sitchin, who says, I'm a scholar, this is what this means. I feel like there's a manipulation that can happen there, and I'm always kind of weary of it, and I can't help that.
Scott, you mentioned it towards the beginning here. You said that whenever you make one of these connections, it makes you laugh, or at least smile. I mean, to me, this is the beauty of what we're doing, is sort of allowing ourselves to be playful, which doesn't take away any validation of this being, quote-unquote, like, real information or like, undeniable connections that we're making here. I only put quote-unquote real because, you know, what is real? But I think it's at the heart of this conversation. But to say, like, I love that you're laughing when you're discovering, because it means that you're playing and allowing yourself to do it that way. And that shouldn't take away one iota of what you're discovering.
Well, I think part of what we do as humans is look for patterns and recognize patterns. And when we find them in unexpected places, it seems kind of funny. You know,
sure. Like,
that shouldn't be there. You know, that it's the same root where humor comes from, where you're noticing an incongruity in a pattern. And so it can trigger that. I feel like I want to tell you just a few facts here to give you a sense of this kind of pattern matching. I recently did an illustration about the number 273. And so let me just give you a few facts. The moon's orbital period is 27.3 days. The menstrual cycle is 27.3 days. Human gestation is 273 days. Sunspots rotate with a period of 27.3 days. The moon diameter divided by the Earth diameter is 0.273. Water liquefies 273 degrees Kelvin. That's above absolute zero. So we have all of these things that somehow resonate with this number. And, you know, they shouldn't really do that, but they do. So it's part of the mystery of the universe.
If I may, 273, I just did the English gematria of it, equals 103. And this is nothing more than the sides of a cube. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So
totally.
If you do the numerical equivalent of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it equals 103. So a little, yeah, a little...
Interesting. Because squaring the circle, which the square implies a cube if you take it up a dimension, but squaring the circle encodes 1.273, because if the square has an edge length of 1, then the circle has a diameter of 1.273.
Interesting.
I had that number showing up just a few times recently, and you know we were obviously obsessed over here with 237 and 723, and it's another variant. And I came across it in a couple films that I watched where I saw it. I think one's on a license plate or something in someplace else. And I was stopping to think about the significance of it. And I loved how that works, how I'm putting it out there that I'm like, that's interesting. I wonder more about that number. And then boom, you just drop
you
it
get
on
more.
Me.
It's like you're programming. You've just made a program and now it's going to give you a return. It's going to give you the information you ask.
I didn't even know. I made my blog HTML or URL, you know, being there 723, and I wasn't even. That was because of when I went to India. I had that number reoccurring. It was my room number that I stayed in Delhi when I first arrived, and then it was something with my plane ticket. There was something with 723, and so I made that my thing. And I didn't even know. I wasn't putting together serious at that moment that the dog days are start of 723. And the outright significance of it. And I wasn't even thinking about it being a variant on 237. It just, in the moment of putting that as my header, and then it's like it all came after the fact. It's very, very strange.
These digits that are important.
Yeah, 7 times 2 times 3 is 42 as well. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, when you were talking about squaring the circle, right, and bringing up this number, you know, the idea of squaring the circle is also the idea that we see in the Kaaba in Mecca, where they're not squaring the circle. What are they doing? They're circling the square.
Yep.
And so you have this idea. And then they do this, where they circumambulate around it 7 times, right? Well, 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6 times 7 is 5,040, and that's exactly what squaring the circle of the Earth will give you, that the combined radii of the Earth and Moon being 5,040. So it's like, you know, once again, just like this really strange and interesting connectivity. It's just fascinating to me. And 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 7 is equals 28. And so now we're back to, you know, 88, and we're back, et cetera, et cetera. It's like you can see that, once again, we're dealing with that language, if you will, of a creator being, of that nature force, that it's like once you start to get that, it's like all of these synchronicities start popping up all the time. And some people call it, what do they call it? I think it's like apophenia or something like that. It's where you start seeing, it's like a psychological, you know, thing where it's like you start seeing patterns. But when you're in mathematics and you have the exactitude of mathematics, you can't make that claim anymore, because it's like, no, Scott's drawing a line from here to here, and it's always going to be that number, you know?
Yeah, like, why is the sun 333,000 times more massive than the Earth?
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It uses these threes.
Oh, you had a correspondence with 237 in the moon's relationship to the Earth, didn't you? I feel like I saw that on Secrets in Plain Sight.
It's a number between moon and Earth. The moon is, what is it? Is it 27.3% the size of the Earth?
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It's another way of saying 3 to 11, approximately.
It's
in proportion.
It's so funny because, you know, you have Jay Widener trying to connect Room 237 to the moon in all these different ways, and then you come out with that, and it's just like, I'm like, does he even know that?
Maybe not, yeah. And the area of a square divided by the area of a circle equals 1.273. It's pretty simple. It's built into the very simplest geometry.
If I may, this might change, I mean, because we're kind of talking about the sun-moon here, this might change the course of the conversation a little bit, but